those of you who were at the preliminary talks I gave probably heard some things which were of great interest to you. Especially, you probably heard quite a few things which indicated that there is so much beyond what people consider to be knowledge these days. There's so much uncharted territory, and this uncharted territory is very important for our well-being and the future of our life. The first uncharted territory that we need to deal with is what actually is the nature of ourself. In order to plan your lifestyle, in order to formulate your career goals, your personal goals, we need to know exactly what is the makeup of my identity. And it is this area that is most lacking in our current fund of knowledge. Our current fund of conventional knowledge is most lacking when it comes to understanding what is our identity. In other words, are we matter? Is that all that's to us? If we are simply just matter, then why should we be so concerned about ourselves? This microphone is matter. The projector screen is matter. If the microphone stand breaks, it's not the end of the world. If the projector screen collapses suddenly, it's not the end of the world. So why is it that if we are simply matter, it's such a tragedy when we have our demise? If we're just matter, it shouldn't matter. In your homes, you regularly wash down the drain in your sink. So much dirty dishwater combined with dishwashing detergent. It all goes down the drain. No one laments. It's not a tragedy. But if someone tries to take you and stuff you down the drain, you'll protest very much. But if you're just matter, why should it matter? So the very emphasis that we place on survival shows that there's something in us that wants to survive despite all obstacles, despite all threats. We should look further and understand, is there something that does not change? Is there something about us that does not change, although the body is always changing and the mind is always changing? Now, it's true, to become acquainted with the spiritual science of Krishna consciousness takes some preparation, no doubt about it. But to walk into any laboratory requires you have some preparation. For example, if someone ushers you to a microscope and you look through the microscope at some slides of biological material, unless you're trained beforehand, you will not recognize what you see. I don't know if any of you have ever tried to do that. Look into a microscope. Without prior knowledge, you can't make heads or tails of what you're looking at. So even ordinary, conventional knowledge requires some preparation and training. In my book that you see over there, Searching for Vedic India, I quote one physicist from Harvard University who says, you know, it takes on the average 8 years to train someone for understanding the strange world of quantum mechanics. It takes 8 years just to twist their head around in such a way that they can think differently and be able to peer into the strange world of quantum mechanics. 8 years. just for preparation so that you can think a different way. Now, why is it that when it comes to spiritual knowledge, we protest against any kind of reorientation or preparation? Why is that? Often, people will say, if the spiritual reality is true, I should be able to see it right now. But there's so many things that you're studying. Maybe some of you in this room are studying things which take years of preparation in order to get some experience of. There's no doubt that our number one priority should be to understand what is my identity. This is not something we should put off, because according to how I think of my identity, that is how I'll mold my life. My goals will be in tune with my conception of myself. If I think I'm just matter, then I'll just try to satisfy myself materially. But if I think I'm more than matter, indeed, if I think I have a spiritual identity, then I'll try for spiritual goals. But where do I get precise knowledge of the spiritual reality? Is it all kind of vague? Is it all kind of cotton wool, new age, whatever? Which anything is everything, and everything is anything, and whatever you do, whatever you feel is spiritual. Is it like that? How can we actually attune ourselves to the spiritual reality? More specifically, how can we purify ourselves? One theme that I'll be mentioning today is that there can be no real clear vision in life without purification, purifying our senses. There can be no real pleasure without purification. I guess we move this microphone. Yes, thank you. Any genuine spiritual practice will offer you a regimen of purification, a methodology of sense purification, so that you can become familiar with non-material realities. There's always a learning curve. Now, if you can understand that there's probably a good reason to believe you're more than just matter, then the goals of your life start to become clear. Rather than just wasting your time trying to satisfy yourself with matter, you embark on some kind of spiritual quest in which you seek to solve the problem of satisfaction by connecting to the spiritual plane. That is what Krishna consciousness is all about. Our main responsibility in life is to understand our spiritual identity. That cannot be done with material methods. With material logic and reason, you can understand that you have a spiritual identity, but you won't be able to experience things just through logic and reason. For example, just looking at your present lifetime. Forget about if you had a previous lifetime. Just look at this lifetime. Your body has changed so many times already. If you're in your 20s, your body has changed at least 3 times. Yet there's something about your core abstract identity that remains the same. What is that? When every cell in your body changes, what is it that remains the same? It used to be, when I would speak about this a few years ago, that some very bright student would always challenge, "Oh, hold it right there. It's not true that every cell in your body changes. Everyone knows the brain cells that you get at the time of birth are what you have at the time of death. The brain cells don't change." I would say, well, first of all, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the most comprehensive and complete spiritual handbook, Krishna says that everything about the body changes. And then I would remind them, you may not know this, but in the past few years, it is now an accepted scientific fact that the brain cells do change. That has been firmly established during the past 3 years. Research at Columbia University and other places, without a doubt, the brain cells change. You get new ones like that. So, therefore, have no doubt, every type of cell in your body changes. What is it about you that doesn't change, although the body does change? You see, it's amazing how deeply entrenched in the materialistic understanding of the self we are. It's just accepted as habit. It's accepted as that's the way it is, when actually, that's the way it's not. I noticed some of you were astonished when I mentioned that it's accepted scientific reality now that the brain cells change. Some of you go, yes, it's true. This has been known for the past 3 years. You can find more information about that in my book, Searching for Vedic India. Moreover, it is possible that you could be a student at RMIT, graduate with the highest degrees, highest honors in mathematics or science, and you have no brain in your head. It is possible. Now, how does our contemporary knowledge base answer that riddle? What would you say if you knew someone at RMIT who graduated with highest honors in mathematics or science, and then later it was found out that they had no brain in their head? What would you say? I don't believe this. Impossible. But once again, in my book, I present authorized knowledge examples from authorized scientific journals about cases in England, particularly at the University of Sheffield, in which indeed that happened. Someone graduated with high honors in mathematics and had an IQ of 126, and they had a kind of a slightly bigger head than most people, this person had. And so this person went to a doctor, the doctor did a scan, and the doctor was astonished. I don't see any brain inside your head. This is all recorded in the journal Science. Other completely authorized and accepted scientific journals. More specifically, this person, if you want to be precise about it, had only 1.5% of the gray matter that he should have. Everything else was gone. There was just a watery substance there in place of where there should be the gray matter. Now, how, with 1.5% of the gray matter that you're supposed to have, how do you graduate with honors in mathematics and physics? You have to think about these things. Now, are you going to empower that 1.5% of gray matter to such an extent that, well, there was a tiny bit there, there are a few particles of brain matter there, therefore that's what did it? If you think that is so, you're really going to have to think deeply about what you're saying. And what is the need of a big brain when a little speck of gray matter can get the job done? What does that say about so-called evolution? Why did the brain evolve the way it has when someone can be a brilliant science student and just have a tiny speck of gray matter? This shows you that there's a lot going on about our identity that we're not aware of. The body can change. The brain cells can change. Even you can have no brain, practically speaking, in your head, and still you have an identity. In fact, a quite functioning identity. Now, once you start seriously dealing with the implications that you have a non-material identity, your next step should be how to fashion for yourself a non-material lifestyle. Be prepared for some people greeting you with some skepticism that, come on, get back to the real world. Come out of the clouds, get back down here on the ground. You've got bills to pay. You have debts to pay. You have social obligations. You have all sorts of things to worry about. What are you doing? Kind of trying to fly high in the spiritual sky. Better come down here where the rest of us are. Don't try to imply that there's another reality. We don't want to be embarrassed by having to feel that we're caught up in a inferior reality while you are getting acquainted with a superior reality. No, you can't do that. We're all stuck on this low level together. Don't try to aspire for anything more. What we have now is the real world. Maybe some of you have heard this before. A question I like to ask is, why must the so-called real world be a place of the lowest aspirations, the most repetitive, hackneyed human behavior? Why must that be the real world? Why can't the real world be a place of the highest spiritual aspirations? So basically, we have a conflict in terms of who says what is the real world. Once we begin to ask these kinds of questions, what is the nature of the self? What is the self composed of? Then we have the responsibility to shape our lifestyle accordingly. In other words, if I am non-material, then why am I trying for material pleasure? Why am I trying to enjoy matter? Next, we begin to deal with the subject of desire. And enjoyment is based on desire. I would like you all to think about that for a while. The power of desire. Why do I want? Why do I hanker? Is it just because of my genes? What is this thing called desire? In the ancient text, Bhagavad Gita, we find out that desire is the most subtle form of activity. Just by having a desire, you're acting. An intelligent person is very concerned about his or her desires. But there's nothing in contemporary so-called civilization to teach you an ultimate solution, a lasting solution to the problem of desire. Most religions overlook desire management. Therefore, people have a hard time. Sometimes people become become exhausted with living in the rat race. They want to turn to spirituality for a breath of fresh air. But they don't understand and they don't get the wisdom about how to deal with their desires. Desire management is essential for a genuine spiritual knowledge. Now, generally speaking, for example, in the Middle Eastern type religions, Christianity, Judaism, they don't deal head on with this desire problem. Then you have Buddhism, in which it is recognized you have desire, but the whole point that's held up to is that you should finish all desire. The Krishna conscious body of wisdom, based on the ancient Vedas of India, holds that you cannot annihilate desire. You have to transform your desire so that you desire the best things and not the inferior things. Desire, in other words, is a symptom of the spirit soul, your spiritual identity. You cannot crush desire. You can't ignore it. You can't annihilate it. Therefore, you have to learn how to live with desire. Living with desire means to change your inferior desires into superior desires. All of you know what it's like to feel the fire of desire burning in you. You have to feed the flames. Sometimes you can walk around in the center of the city here, or go to some shopping center or mall, and you can feel the flames of desire. You've got to feed those flames. You can go to parties or other social events, and you feel your desires. Your desires want certain things. What to do about that fire of desire? It seems even to get you into trouble sometimes. Even against your best knowledge and judgment, your desires get you in trouble. How can you manage your desires in the most conducive way? This is what we should be thinking about, because you cannot extinguish desires. It is true that if you have no higher knowledge of how to cope with desire, it's better you just temporarily suspend your desires. But that's not the lasting solution. By temporarily suspending your desires, at least for a short time, you're not causing havoc in the world. Let's say you have a naughty kid in your house, and as soon as you turn your back, the kid is smearing ketchup on the walls and, you know, writing on the walls with crayons. You may, or the child's parent may, just tell the child, sit in the corner and don't come out. I don't know, maybe some of you here were sat in a corner at one point in time when you were a little kid. Your parents just said, just sit in the corner. Is that a solution to your life's problems? No, you can only stay in the corner a certain amount of time before you want to be active and come out. But at least while you sat in the corner, you weren't causing havoc, and you gave your parents some respite, some rest. So if you just tell people, stop your desires, annihilate all desires, desire nothing, and then you'll be free, that is not a lasting solution. It's a temporary measure. You don't know what to do with yourself, so just stop. Sit in the corner of life. At least in that way, people will be less disturbed temporarily before you come out of the corner again. Sit in the corner, do deep breathing, meditate on your breath, meditate on a picture of a candle or something. Just sit in the corner, don't do anything. This is some people's idea of world peace. Finish off all desires. Annihilate all desires. But that is impossible. The best solution for dealing with desire is given by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, that you transfer the lower desires to the spiritual reality, because you cannot kill the desires. Desires are the expression of the eternal spirit soul. Rather than futilely trying to annihilate desire, we need to know how to desire in perfection. That is the great advantage of Krishna consciousness. It's about how to desire perfectly. very important to know, especially since we cannot kill desire. You can make that experiment. Try to stop your desires. You can't. You want to want. It's not simply that you want, but you also want to want. You desire to desire because you feel normal and functioning in that way. More so even than breathing and eating and sleeping. You want to want and you desire to desire because in that way you feel like I exist, I have a role to play in this world simply because of desire. I remember I was in Thailand once and I was a few years ago and I was talking to various monks in Thailand. And one of them from England told me a very interesting story. He had been a monk in Thailand for 10 years and he had become a renowned teacher of meditation. Many persons from the UK and Germany would come to Thailand to take classes from him and how to meditate on the incoming and outgoing breath. So he took a vow that for 5 years he would live outside his monastery in a hut and just meditate on his breath all day long, in spite of the heat or mosquitoes. He did that for 5 years, sitting in a hut, just meditating on the incoming and outgoing breath, noting the different qualities of each breath. Naturally, he became very peaceful, very tolerant. But is that the ultimate solution? Did that solve his problem of desire? His desires were temporarily suspended. But then what happened? He told me himself. One day a villager came by blaring one of these boom boxes and walked by the meditation hut of this monk. And the boombox was playing one of these real syrupy songs from the 50s. Tell Laura I love her. Tell Laura I need her. Maybe some of you remember that song. And as the person walked by his meditation hut with the boombox blaring, tell Laura I love her. Tell Laura I need her. The monk all of a sudden realized that tears were streaming down his cheeks. And then he told me, I was astonished. I felt the tears on my cheeks. I couldn't believe it. The sentiment had overwhelmed me just by hearing this song from the 50s. It had ignited something in me. So I said, you see, this is the power of desire. For 5 years you suspended your desires, but you didn't get rid of them. The living entity has a natural capacity to desire. So you simply heard this song, and it triggered off in you your desires, which were not annihilated. In other words, attaining nirvana means freedom from distress. But that's a negative. What do you actually do positively? The Sanskrit term nirvana means out of the forest. Once you're out of the forest of illusion, then where are you? That's the most important knowledge to know, because you have to deal with your desires. You can't simply repress your desires, you've got to find out how to desire in perfection. You've got to find out how to desire properly once you're out of the forest of illusion. So that kind of knowledge is the most valuable kind of knowledge. And that is what Krishna consciousness is about. Desire management. What to do with your desires when you're in the material reality, and what to do with your desires when you're in the spiritual reality. Because we may know nothing of the spiritual reality, we think that there'll be a great solution in our life simply to say, all my desires are zero, myself is zero, now there's peace. But if you're very sick and you go to the hospital, is the solution to your situation that you should be killed so that there's some imaginary peace? Or is the better solution that you become healthy, that you get over the disease? Similarly, we don't want to kill desire. We want to learn how to desire perfectly. That is Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness begins beyond nirvana, beyond the freedom from material distress. Just like Buddha. Buddha said, I've come to teach two things and two things only. What is dukkha, distress, and how to become free from dukkha, distress. Okay, very good. Now that you may become free from distress, what do you do? How do you desire? These are very important questions. How do you manage that fire of desire, which sooner or later is going to get you in trouble? Whether you hear tell Laura I love her on the radio, or or things even more explicit. How are you going to deal with the fire of desire? Let's not play, let's pretend that we have no desires. Let's pretend that desire doesn't exist. No. Krishna consciousness deals with the real world. You and your desires. Are your desires material or are they spiritual? These are very important points for us to understand. Now, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna deals quite squarely with these issues. He explains that you may try to discipline your life. You may try to control your senses. You may try to curtail your sensory activity, but you'll fail. Krishna says you'll fail. Simply having a lifestyle of sensory discipline and control. The only way to succeed, Krishna explains, is when you get the higher spiritual taste, automatically you'll let go of the lower spiritual taste. Krishna consciousness, or bhakti yoga, is all about how to connect to the higher spiritual taste so that automatically you'll let go of the lower thing. Let us say one of you has an old car. Maybe, who knows, a 1970 Morris Minor. And you're very attached to that car. It's all you have. And I make fun of it. Get rid of that junker. How can you even bring it out on the road? It's a disgrace. You might feel very offended. This is all I have. It gets me to my classes. Why are you criticizing me? Why are you criticizing my car? You might feel offended. You might feel hurt. Put down. And here I am just saying, get rid of it. Throw it out. It's a junker. It's a lemon. Naturally, you'll cling. It's all I've got. It's something anyway. But suppose, instead, I come driving up to your student hostel or to your flat with a brand new Mercedes, and I walk into your door and say, I toss the keys at you. Okay, it's all yours. Take it away. Just one condition. Throw out the Morris Minor. You wouldn't hesitate. Of course, no problem. What Morris Minor? Never had one. Just give me the keys and the Mercedes. So that's what Krishna is explaining in Bhagavad Gita. You may try to control your senses, Krishna says, you may try to live a lifestyle of discipline. You may try to have a Spartan existence, but you'll fail unless you get a superior pleasure to replace the inferior pleasure that you're trying to avoid. So this is the real knowledge of yoga. How to connect with the ultimate reality. What is the nature of that ultimate reality? Pleasure. That is what Krishna means. Krishna means the all-attractive reservoir of pleasure. The source of all energies is the reservoir of pleasure. Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita how he emanates both the inferior material energy and the superior spiritual energy. Therefore, if we're going to master reality, we have to understand the energies that are around, and we have to understand the source of those energies. What is the nature of the source of all energies? Why should we just say, there's energy? What about the energetic source? Actually, the source of the energies is more important than the energies, because the energies are coming from that source. Where are you going to get knowledge of the ultimate source of all energy? In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, the source of everything, speaks. Now, you are not unlimited. We're all limited here. We can speak with conscious awareness. Why can't the source of all energy speak with conscious awareness? If we can take instruction from the source of all energies, our life becomes very advantageous. Because the source of all energies knows how to best deal with the energies. In other words, if we take our knowledge from Krishna, the source of all energies, we'll have no problem dealing with the various types of energies emanating from Krishna. We'll be able to deal with the material energy. We'll be able to deal with the spiritual energies. If we can get the information from the source, the conscious source of all energy. Now, in Bhagavad Gita, that conscious source of all energies describes himself. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am the source of all the spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. How many people will say such a thing? Can you imagine yourself saying such a thing? Even on your wildest nights, you wouldn't be able to say such a thing and have anybody take you seriously. How many of you go to a pub and get a bit juiced up and then say, by the way, mates, I am the source of everything. You have anyone here like that? No, I don't think so. For Krishna in Bhagavad Gita to say he's the source of everything is an extraordinary claim, and we should pay attention to it. Especially since in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives you the methodology how to verify his claim. Now, what more could you want? Krishna says, I am the source of everything. Here is the process you can follow to verify that. What more can we want? If we can arrange our life so that we take our information from the source of everything, then we can know how to deal with all the energies. That makes for living a successful lifestyle, to know how to deal with all the assorted energies that we find in existence. Basically, those energies that we find in existence can be classified as material and spiritual, or as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, inferior and superior. In your own individual existence, you'll find this combination of material energy and spiritual energy. Your body, your mind, your intelligence, they are matter, both gross and subtle. But your real identity is spiritual. So your life as it is now is a combination of matter and spirit. That's why you just don't feel completely right. You always feel there's something a bit out of whack. What's out of whack? What's a bit off kilter? That pure spirit soul is in a material body trying to enjoy matter. That causes a few problems. Therefore, you can't really be satisfied with material desires. They always lead you to frustration. Even if you get what you want, that thing that you want becomes stale. And that's such a disappointing feeling. I know you've all experienced that. A few times you get completely what you want, you have to watch that thing become stale right before your eyes. That's the nature of material existence. Material existence means an existence ruled by the laws of time and space and thought. These three limitations, time, space, and thought, box you in and subject you to the passing of time, deterioration. All matter does that. But is there another energy that does not deteriorate? In fact, the spiritual energy increases in freshness. Not even does it stay stable. No, the spiritual energy increases in freshness. Just like the material energy is always deteriorating, running down, the spiritual energy is always running up, increasing in freshness. Now, how are you going to experience this? It could be me just talking, you know. I say, yeah, sounds good, but, you know, how do we tap into all this? That is why we have the techniques of Krishna consciousness, so that you can actually experience what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. And then your life becomes quite successful. You know how to deal with desires. Managing desires means how to transfer your desires from the material plane to the spiritual plane by desiring things that are in harmony with spiritual perfection. So it's not a question of annihilating your desires or denying your capacity to desire. It is simply to match your desires with spiritual perfection. In fact, to be Krishna conscious, to attain spiritual perfection, means to have spiritual desires which go on and on increasing. Don't think that the best thing you can do with desires is just to stop them or to limit them. No, in spiritual life, your desires can become ever fresh and there's ever opportunity for them. But that can't be done on the material platform of life. Therefore, to satisfy people, they actually have to live a non-material lifestyle. People are a little bit afraid of that. Well, you have to do without so many things. I remember myself, my last month at Yale University, I turned on the television while I was finishing my last bit of studies before graduation, and there were some Hare Krishna people talking on a television show, explaining their lifestyle, explaining their discipline and sense control. And I just turned to my flatmate and said, these people are crazy. How can there be happiness without uncontrolled senses? This is something I'm sure most of you are wondering about. Because constantly the message is being broadcast to you. Let your senses go. Don't try to control them. That's the path to perfection. Can't you see all the happy people with uncontrolled senses? No, you don't see them. But no one knows anything else to do. Okay, I know I've been miserable with uncontrolled senses. I know I've been miserable and frustrated with uncontrolled desires. But what else is there to do with my senses, with my desires? To answer this question means to understand what is Krishna consciousness. How to desire in perfection. How to use your senses in perfection. Since everything emanates from Krishna, everything belongs to Krishna. Krishna is the authority on how to deal with all the energies that come from him. So if you take your information from Krishna, how to desire, how to use your senses, how to interact with the various energies of this world, whether matter or spirit, then you are in the most advantageous position to have a successful lifetime. But without that kind of knowledge, even if you have vast wealth, you'll not be happy. Even if you have worldwide fame, you'll not be happy. It is essential for every thinking person to take knowledge from Krishna, how to desire, how to use the senses. Another name for Krishna is Hrishikesh, the Lord of the senses. Take your information from the master of the senses, how to use your senses. Then you can function, you can act on the platform of spiritual perfection. This is the best kind of information that we should be concerned with. Otherwise, what we call pleasure, what is it? You cannot tell me one material activity of pleasure that you can do continuously without either hurting yourself or going crazy. Continuously. Just think of your favorite so-called pleasurable activity. Don't say it. Just, you cannot indulge in that way day after day after day, night after night after night, nonstop, without getting sick of that activity. That should let you know. Is a basic problem. But spiritual activity, Krishna conscious activity, you can indulge in those kind of activities nonstop, and the taste will simply get sweeter and sweeter. That's why there's spiritual activities, ever fresh, ever increasing in potency. And the material activities, they're going downhill. They become stale. They become disappointing. These are the kind of things we should be thinking of. The fire of desire. How can I deal with my desires properly? How can I manage my own desires? Most people cannot administrate their own desires. They can't manage their own desires. They don't know what to do with their desires. They don't even think about their having desires. You should try making an experiment over the next 2 weeks. Chart the flow of your desires. Note down what you're desiring and how those desires are either delayed or indulged in or ignored. And then you'll see the story of your life. Measured in terms of desire. Some people get so frustrated with their desires and how they've been disappointed that they think, okay, the solution is no desire. Annihilate all desire. That is impossible. You can only do that temporarily. The ultimate solution to the problem of desire is to learn how to desire in perfection. That is Krishna consciousness. When the individual spirit soul desires to satisfy the supreme soul, Krishna, that is perfection. We are limited parts, limited entities of consciousness, and we are part of the supreme consciousness. Krishna consciousness means to understand the relationship between the individual soul and the supreme soul. Then we'll know what to do with desire. We'll desire how to harmonize with the spiritual perfection of the source of all energy. What I'm presenting to you is nothing pie in the sky. You can do it. You can be successful at this. And then you can teach others how to be most successful. You can teach others the art of desire management, how to desire in perfection. Remember, material desires mean things in relation to the body and mind. But to desire in perfection means to desire things on the spiritual plane, things in relation to the individual soul and the supreme soul, Krishna. That's actually really yoga, the perfection of yoga. All right, might there be any questions? I've given you a lot to chew on. Yes. You've read that.
Yes, I was just wondering why the next
one. So you've read Bhagavad Gita. Very good. The three modes of material nature are material. Let me give you an example. Maybe not so much in Australia, but in New Zealand, people are very conscious of the winds. And they have names for the different types of winds, depending on where the winds are originated. I think here in Australia, you just say like a cold wind is blowing or something. But in New Zealand, they say it's, you know, southerly or southwestern or northwestern. And just by that, the people know the type of weather it's going to be just by your saying the direction the wind's coming from. They know the southerly is bringing cold air off the Antarctica. The northwesterlies are bringing warm air down from Australia. So different winds have different effects on our life. The three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, ignorance, they are environmental influences that affect us according to the type of body we have. If you have a body composed mainly of passion, because of your activities in your past life, you've generated for yourself a body predominantly in passion, you'll be very prone to influence by the mode of passion blowing through. You may walk down the street and there's a, you know, walk past a barbecue place or a sausage, you know, what do you call them, you know, these, you know, people are trying to raise money for their sausage sizzle. You walk past a sausage sizzle and, ooh. That means you're being subjected to the mode of passion and you have a weakness for the mode of passion. Or, you know, an attractive sex object walks past you and you immediately, that's the mode of passion. There's even worse than that. A mode of ignorance. A mode of ignorance means you're influenced by just the desire to be intoxicated, lazy, listless. Then there's the mode of goodness, which is also material, but it's like the highest level of material existence. In the mode of goodness, you live a life of discipline, sense control, modesty, cleanliness, free from violence, free from aggressive desire. You have some desires, but they're very simple. The mode of goodness is like you're having a cold, the sniffles. The mode of passion is like you're having heart disease. And the mode of ignorance is like you're having some terminal disease. So these modes of material nature are different types of material illusion. They have differing degrees of severity. Still, they're all material, even the mode of goodness. If you want to be even materially successful in your life, you have to solve the problem of passion and ignorance. At least come to the material mode of goodness. In the material mode of goodness, your vision is clear and you can begin to understand spiritual knowledge. But passion and ignorance make it very difficult to understand who you are and why you're in this world. It's like driving a car with mud splattered all over the windscreen. There are psychologists now in universities who are using the Vedic model of the three modes of nature and performing psychological tests. So which mode or modes do you think influence you? That's good then. It means you live a very clean life of discipline, sense control. You're always attuned to higher subject matter. You're not interested in the lusts, greeds, and envy and jealousy that plague most people. You're aloof from the crowds. You like living in a quiet place. You like contemplating the ultimate questions of life. Yes? Okay. Mode of goodness persons are very suited to become Krishna conscious. A mode of goodness person understands, I can't just be matter, there's something more about me. So where do I get that kind of information? Still, the mode of goodness can cause you to be attached to the temporary world, because if you're actually in the mode of goodness, you're kind of contented, you know? You're kind of peaceful. Oh, life's not so bad. Why are all these people working so hard in a rat race? You don't need to work that hard. Just live simply. Have a little bit. Have lots of time for contemplation, discussing with others. So the mode of goodness person can become attached to that and not push himself, herself, for the actual spiritual platform, which is beyond even the material mode of goodness. It's like you look around and say, everyone else has got heart disease, terminal cancer, I just got the sniffles. Hey, life's good. But why not get rid of the sniffles too?
If material energy flows downwards or is always decreasing, then why are we attracted to it in the first place?
We like the matrix of illusion. Did you see, you remember the movie Matrix you saw? Most people don't want to be unplugged. Remember Cypher when he was leaving the Nebuchadnezzar, the hovercraft, and wanting to get back into the matrix of illusion? Remember him talking to Agent Smith? What did he say to Agent Smith?
Ignorance is bliss.
When I stick my teeth into this steak, I know it's just all digitally created. I know it's an illusion. I don't care. I just want it. Make me famous. Make me rich. Make me an actor. I'll do whatever you want. Just, you know. Plug me back into the illusion. I'm tired of reality. Of course, the reality that was presented, just flying around in that hovercraft, is not very attractive. Similarly, if you just present to people that the world's an illusion, drop it. It's not very attractive for them because they want to know what's better. Just like Cypher said, hey, I'd rather be in the Matrix than, you know, the so-called reality. So therefore, you can choose the red pill or the blue pill. What would you say for yourself? Then? Taking the red pill means learning how to desire in perfection. Because you cannot stop desiring. So I recommend you try to understand what is Krishna consciousness. Yes.
There's a phrase in Gita which says, and which Krishna says, rules of karma and reasons are coming. And as per rule, this says karma means the material world. It's written from a materialistic world. So if you are saying to leave the materialistic world, what does this phrase mean?
Ashwini, what was the first part that he said? Yes, the first part. Yes, in India they generally just quote the first half of that verse and forget the second half. Yes, Krishna says, you have a right to perform your duty. But what's the second half of say? All right. Like everyone in India. This is called half the hen philosophy. You take the part, yeah, this is an example for me to use. You take the part of the hen that lays the egg, but you forget about the part of the hen that the mouth you have to feed. So this is half the hen philosophy. Half the verse is Bhagavad Gita. So many places I go in India, you know, this verse is quoted. Kamanivatakaraste, Swamiji, Krishna says you have a right to do your duty. You have a right to perform your karma. What's the second half of the verse? Right. Yeah. There are billions, millions, like, who've done like that also. Krishna says you have a right to perform your duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits. The fruits means the results of your labor. Bhagavad Gita is trying to teach you how to perform non-reactive work. How to perform work that has no karmic reaction. So Krishna says you have a right to do your duties in this world, but you have no right to claim the fruits of your labor as yours. Sounds very interesting, doesn't it? You would think. If I'm doing something, the fruits, the results belong to me, right? My money, my success, right? Now, why in the world would you be encouraged to do your duty and not get to enjoy the results? Why? Because Krishna is offering you something better than enjoying the fruits of your labor. Krishna is offering you himself. the supreme reservoir of pleasure. So Krishna is saying, do your duty, but think of me. Do your duty, but dedicate the results to me. And that way you'll be supremely satisfied, because your activities are connected to the supreme source of everything. They become purified because the results are going to Krishna. Everything belongs to Krishna anyway. You get the credit for recognizing that. But if you just want to act in the matrix of illusion, you saw the movie Matrix? So, what do you think? You'd be happy just plugged in and... No. Even though you may not know what is better, still, sometimes you feel, at least I should know what is real. But if you don't know what is better, you won't be able to stay situated in what is real, because you are pleasure seeking. The better thing, the better reality, has to be better pleasure. Otherwise, you will not stick to it. You'll do just like Cypher did. Let me go back. More than the truth, you seek pleasure. That's actually the truth. Now you have to find what is the ultimate pleasure. That Krishna is trying to teach you in Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, Krishna says, you can do your duty, but you can't have the results. Because Krishna knows that's inferior pleasure when you try to enjoy your own results. Krishna wants that you have Him, the supreme source of all pleasure. Okay? Can you do it? Can you do it?
I can try this.
And what will it get you?
In a money stuff, I will get money, I will get status, I will get...
And what will all that do for you?
I get a spare one, give me happiness.
You really? Sure? You're sure? Money status is going to make you happy. And you've looked around and seen so many happy people with money and status. Really? I've been on every continent of the world. I've associated, even in my youth, with some of the wealthiest, most influential people in this world. And I know for a fact they are miserable. You cannot be satisfied materially. Even if you are physically comfortable, if your mind is disturbed, it's such a painful thing. You are not matter, so how can material things satisfy you? Not possible. You must tap into the source of spiritual pleasure. That is Krishna consciousness. So don't waste your time trying to get something which no one else has ever gotten before. Everyone has failed. Let's say you have a lot of money. Now how is that going to make you happy? I've got money. I've got so much money. I can buy this. I can buy that. Money, money. Okay. Your stomach still holds the same amount of food, right? Oh, no. You're from India? Anyone from India, even a person with modest means of income, knows how to cook wonderful food at a low price. Okay. So. What's wrong with cooking?
You have to work. You have to work hard for it. Cooking is not an easy job. What I think. So you got money, you don't have to go. If you eradicate one work all your life, you got money, you can have a cook for that.
What else do you want?
As a youth, I'm still young, I'm 23 years old. My experience here. I just say anybody, like 98% of people, they're experiencing to have the money, to have a good car, to have a good house, and all that.
And they're happy.
Yeah, and this way, I'm saying at this way.
No, they're not happy. And they always want more and more. Don't you know the social statistics? Divorce, anxiety, stress. Don't you know all about that? You don't get the happiness by these material pursuits. You get the social problems, the psychological problems, the mental breakdowns, and the physical breakdowns too. Better you live a simple life and try to understand Krishna consciousness.
And practically, if you tell me something in a few words, what do you tell me? In a few words, in practical terms.
You're not the body, you're a spirit soul, you're part of Krishna, the Supreme Soul.
What should I do?
You study Bhagavad Gita, we have one here. Why waste your time pursuing suicide materialistic goals? Okay? Yes.
Well, at the end of your book, Search for Vedic India, you said the present time is the best time. That's the misconception people have. That this is the better time. So, like medicine wars and every benefits wars. So is it something that Kali Yuga or the people like us who make this decision?
You're referring to people today thinking that now is the greatest time ever for human beings. This is the most progressive, advanced time. They say that because they don't have knowledge of the past. You're going to see about that in the movie, the video you'll see, Hidden History of the Human Race. Vedic knowledge will tell you that the caliber of human beings you have now is the lowest. That's a shock for many people. Therefore, in my book, Searching for Vedic India, I've pointed out a lot of things to get you thinking that the way people are today is the lowest standard. You can see how the computers have gotten faster, the communication systems have gotten faster, but people are more stressed and full of anxiety than ever before. Anything else? Yes? That is certainly a more peaceful lifestyle, conducive for higher thinking. But no one thinks about growing food these days. They'd rather eat silicon chips or something, you know? Yes. We should try to have lifestyles that allow us the opportunity for contemplation. Life doesn't have to be so complicated. So while you're growing your fruits and veggies, you should think, who is the source of all this food growing? Who provides the conditions that this food grows? Is it all by chance? Is it just the random interaction of atomic particles? Then you must dedicate your life to finding out the best information about that superior being. The most comprehensive, the most full information about that superior being you talk about. Yes. So I recommend you try to understand Krishna consciousness. Yes.
Do you come across the Hanses? The Hansa civilization? They live a very simplistic lifestyle and grow food themselves and live till great ages. Just wondering if you come across it.
It's more than simply a long lifestyle and growing some fruits and veggies of your own. It's all about being in contact with superior knowledge and then applying that knowledge in your life. If you take your information from Krishna, the source of all energies, and apply that in your life, then whether you're growing your own fruits or veggies or not, whether you have a long lifespan or a short lifespan, your life will be successful. It's all about where you're getting your information from. So yes, as Krishna conscious practitioners, we cheer on all those who want to live simple lifestyles which allow them much time for contemplating the big questions of life. While simultaneously, we want to point out that for a superior lifestyle, you have to be in contact with a superior source of information. That superior source of information is the source of all energies, matter and spirit. You take your information from there, and then your life can be successful. That is Krishna consciousness. Last question? Yes.
In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says to follow the path of Karma Yoga. That is, I have to be in this world, and at the same time, I have to be unattached. This thing seems something impossible to me. How is it possible?
What are you studying in school?
I'm studying IT.
IT. I think that's impossible. I just think it's impossible. IT? Impossible. How can anyone understand that? What would you say? Huh? You say that if you really want to understand, you make the effort, right?
No, it is said that I have to practice, I have to do two things, abhyas and vairagya. So abhyas is something clear, okay, but what is vairagya? I am unable to understand what is vairagya.
Vairagya is a Sanskrit word that means renunciation, okay. Letting go of what's not good for you. But let's go back to my point. You're studying IT. Suppose I say, well, that's impossible. How can anyone understand that? But you're saying, karma yoga, performing activities for the pleasure of Krishna, the Supreme, how can anyone do that in this world? It's just a question of learning, that's all. I can say that about IT. IT, how is it possible? How can you ever study that? But you just say it's a question of understanding and application. If you want to understand how to perform activities, karma-free activities, non-reactive work for the pleasure of Krishna, then you take up some study from someone who knows. Okay? Krishna himself says in Bhagavad Gita, the intricacies of acting in this world for perfection are difficult. Therefore, you need to take guidance. Krishna himself says that. He says, an intelligent person can see action in inaction and inaction in action. In other words, you may say you're being inactive, but by your desires, you are active. And you may be doing so many things, just like Arjuna fighting on the battlefield. So much action, but actually you may be inactive because your work has no reactions, no karma. Because it's perfectly connected to Krishna. You understand? Alright. Well, thank you all very much for your kind attention. I hope some of you will look deeper into Krishna consciousness and think seriously about a lifestyle of desire management. How to desire in perfection. Thank you very much.